Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas is now in session.
Thank you. Be seated. This morning, the court has three causes on its oral submission docket. In the order of the presentation, they are as follows. Republic Life Insurance and Southwest Adjustment Services Incorporated versus Linda H. Stoker and John Stoker from El Paso County. Randall's Food Markets Incorporated, Vernon Frank Davis, Lewis Simmons, and Gary Mike Niels versus Mary Lynn Johnson from Galveston County. And Robert D. Benson is next friend of Brookley Dawn Benson, a minor, versus Ford Motor Company from Harris County. In each cause, the court has allotted 20 minutes for oral argument. Petitioners may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising the marshal of the court. The court will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each argument. These arguments are being recorded for the court's convenience. If you desire to listen to a tape of the arguments, you may make application with our clerk. Justice Heck will not be present today, but he will participate in the deliberation and decision of these clauses. The court is ready to hear from petitioners in Republic Insurance versus Stoker.
May it please the court, Mr. Joseph L. Hood, Jr. will present arguments for petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. In the 7 years since Arnold versus National County Fire Insurance Company was decided, this court and others throughout the state have sought to define the contours of an insurance carrier's extra-contractual liability to its insurer. In today's case, we face the issue of whether extra-contractual liability can exist in the absence of coverage under the policy. The precise issue before the court is whether a claims representative's actions in denying a claim that is otherwise invalid for what a prior fact might later consider to be a wrong reason can somehow give rise to a cause of action for damages under the guise of an extra-contractual theory.
But another way, is the question basically, can extra-contractual liability exist in the absence of contractual liability?
Well, you have to go a little further than that, Justice Doggett. You can have, in certain instances, I believe, and I think as we've demonstrated in our application, extra-contractual liability in the absence of a contractual duty, but you have to identify the source of those damages. When you have a case such as this, in essence, what we have here is where the insured has recovered damages for a casualty loss not covered by the policy of insurance. There is no dispute that coverage did not exist for this loss at the time it occurred. The only damages sought in the pleadings, the only damages awarded at trial, consisted of two elements. Number one, the very casualty loss for which there was no coverage, $1,900 in the cost of repair of the vehicle. The other element of damage, $5,000 in mental anguish. What's the evidence of that? I was very disappointed because I felt they were obligated to pay for my car. That stems from the very same casualty loss. You do not have a situation where the insured has sustained a distinct loss resulting from the investigation or handling of his or her claim.
What might that be?
It's very difficult for me to imagine that type of scenario, Justice Cornyn, but there have been certain cases where that can come up.
If you were denied a homeowner's fire claim because the insurance company said it was arson, and it really was that you didn't get your proof of loss in on time or your policy had lapsed for some reason, could that be an element where the very grounds of denial could create separate liability?
Well, if your policy has lapsed, Chief Justice Phillips, you don't have any coverage for that particular loss.
But if they don't deny it on that ground.
It's sort of like the harmless error rule. You know, my clients and I live in the real world where we don't get extra points for doing the right thing for the right reason. What matters in the end is the right result. And that's the issue that we have before the court today.
And it really makes no difference how long the insurance company strings along the policyholder, how much delay there is. how many misrepresentations there are by the claims adjuster. So long as there's not coverage and they finally discover that at some time before judgment is entered, they are relieved of any extra contractual liability.
Under our position, yes.
And so
that
what,
is not, of course, the facts in this case because the denial occurred within a very brief period.
But well, you're arguing we have to overrule Biles.
No, I'm not.
Language in Biles.
I am arguing that the language in Biles, that whether or not a reasonable basis exists must be determined at the time of denial, does not invariably apply in every case, and it should not apply in this case. We take no issue with the basic proposition set forth in Biles, that the cause of action for breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing, whether it be at common law or whether it be through the Deceptive Trade Practices Act or Article 21.21 of the Insurance Code, is a separate cause of action apart from a cause of action for breach of contract. So far, so good. That means, just as we had in Biles, that the mere fact that the insured loses on the contract will not always mean that he or she should lose on the extra contractual claim. The converse is also true. Lyons and Dominguez and now Moriel teach us that just because the insurer loses on the contract claim doesn't mean that it also loses on the extra contractual claim.
Biles would survive to the extent that if there is coverage in some intervening event from the date of the loss, ultimately defeats coverage like failure to cooperate or failure to notify the insurance company, file a timely proof of loss, that sort of thing. Biles would be limited to those circumstances.
Absolutely. We're talking here about coverage. And let's look at the basic aspects of a policy of insurance. You have two basic types of clauses in there. You have the coverage clause that defines the risk that the company agrees to assume. That's the basic contract. That defines the insurer's obligation to pay for that particular loss. That's what the insured has bargained for. On the other hand, you have conditions that require the insured to take particular steps to secure the coverage he has bargained for. Proof of loss, notice in the event of a lawsuit, things of that nature. If you go back to traditional common law contractual principles, we know that waiver and estoppel cannot be used to create coverage where none exists. On the other hand, waiver and estoppel can be used to prevent a forfeiture of the coverage, either because of the insured's untimely raising of an exclusion to the general risk, or because of the insured's failure to comply with a condition proceeding to recovery. And indeed, that's all that Biles was about. All you had in Biles was the fact that the insured had failed to give timely proof of loss under the claim. There was no doubt about the existence of coverage under the basic insuring agreement. This case is different. In this case, the question is whether or not the loss comes within the policy, and clearly it doesn't. There was no contact between the Stoker's vehicle and the uninsured truck. The trial court found that was undisputed. There was no genuine issue of material fact, issued a summary judgment. The Court of Appeals, in a thoroughly reasoned opinion, affirmed that judgment.
And it is also undisputed that at the time your carrier denied the claim, that was in no way a basis for the denial of claim.
I concede that fully, Your Honor. But does it really matter? If I'm right for the right reason, is that really any different in the business world for being right for the wrong reason? This is not like a law school exam where even if you get the wrong answer but apply the correct analysis, you get a good grade.
Mr. Hood, is there anything in Biles or Aranda that requires, well, let's assume Biles applies to this, and you accept Biles' statement that the reason given for the denial had to be based on the facts that existed at the time the denial was, a reasonable basis for denying the claim had to exist at the time that the denial was made. Let's assume that's the proposition Biles stands for. Did your client, Republic Insurance Southwest, at the time that they denied the claim, had a reasonable basis for denying the claim?
Sure they did. There was no contact between the vehicles, and I might also add,
is there anything in Biles or Aranda that holds an insurer to having been given the correct reason at the time they denied the claim?
Well, absolutely not, because if you look back at Aranda, it talks about the first part of it is the objective test, whether a reasonable insurer faced with this situation would have in fact denied the claim. And here, that's undisputed. Your hypothetical reasonable insurer would have certainly denied this claim because no coverage existed. And what the Court of Appeals has done in this case, seizing upon the language in Biles, is saying that really doesn't apply here because subjectively the insurer guessed wrong and relied upon the wrong reason. And that's inconsistent with the objective test that this court set forth in Aranda. The true irony of the case is this. The basic claim here is that the evaluation and investigation of the claim was sloppy in that it placed most of the blame on Mrs. Stoker rather than the truck that dumped the furniture. But if you carry the argument to the logical extreme, a truly proper investigation, the one that would have been undertaken by the hypothetical reasonable insurer, and indeed the one that the plaintiffs apparently are arguing should have been present in this case, would have discovered the fact of no coverage. The question, quite simply, is this. How are the Stokers any worse off in February when they learn that their claim is being denied because Mr. Ponce believes that Mrs. Stoker was at fault in causing the accident than they were a year and a half later after litigation has ensued and a district court judge has said you lose because there's no coverage? We don't have a situation where the insured took any action on its part in reliance upon the investigation.
If they had, would it make a difference?
I think that it would, but I don't think that you need to resort to, quote, bad faith principles to reach that result. Traditional common law doctrines protect the insured. As you have pointed out many times, Justice Doggett, there is nothing unique about the insurance industry. Let's take the example, and I go back to your question earlier, Justice Corn. Let's suppose that Mr. Ponce is in the process of going through his investigation. Mrs. Stoker calls him up and she says, Abe, I'm really wanting to know what you guys are going to do about coverage because I don't carry collision, and if this loss is not covered under my uninsured motorist coverage, I'm not going to have the car fixed. It's not worth it to me. And Abe says at that point, well, you know, Mrs. Stoker, I've looked into this and I think that you are covered. There's no issue about your fault or anything of that nature. Go ahead and get your car fixed. She goes out and fixes her car. At that point, neither Republic nor its claims adjusting firm, Southwest, can come back in and say, well, we're sorry, but there was no coverage, either because she was more at fault than everyone else or because there was no contact between the vehicles. Now, why in this instance do we allow the insurer to recover? Well, you resort to traditional principles of promissory estoppel. You have a promise by the claims person. You have detrimental reliance on the part of the insured. So in that instance, sure, the claims person's actions caused the loss. There would have been $1,900 in repairs incurred that she would not have otherwise done. Now, apart from that, what other instances can we have? Well, the Rawlings versus Apodaca case out of the Supreme Court of Arizona, which was cited in Morial, also presents a situation in which coverage issues may not affect the extra contractual issues. But there you have a very unique situation. You have an insured with Farmers who has $10,000, sustains a fire loss well in excess of his limit of coverage. It's caused by an adjoining landowner who is also insured with Farmers who has $100,000 in liability coverage. And in that instance, rather than assist the insured after leading the insured to believe that it would file a subrogation claim, the insurer hides its report. For the life of me, I've read Rawlings versus Apodaca any number of times, and I have a hard time at seeing what the actual damages were to the insured because the insured ultimately sued his neighbor and recovered under that farmer's liability policy. But situations are very, very difficult to envision when you are talking about an absence of coverage.
Doesn't that allow the insurer two times to deny coverage? In other words, you're saying if at either time, at the time of trial or at the time of the original denial, there's no coverage, there's no recovery. Is that correct?
That's our basic proposition, yes.
And the insured, on the other hand, who has purchased insurance have to negate both of those? In other words, they file a claim and it's denied. They, in addition, have to foresee that at a later time there may be another reason it could be denied.
Well, I think so, and I don't necessarily see that there's anything wrong with that. You know, Mr. Ponce is scattered across the pages of the Southwestern Reporter second series, but the one thing that everybody seems to have forgotten is that there's been no jury determination in this case that, in fact, the dump-and-run driver was more than 50% at fault and that Mrs. Stoker was less than 50% at fault. There's nothing inequitable or inherently wrong about making the insured prove his or her cause of action in conformity with the terms of the policy.
Without going into all of that and without either disapproving, overruling, or qualifying vials or Aranda, can your client not prevail in this case solely on the basis that there's no evidence of damages?
Well, I think that clearly that's one of the points we've raised, Justice Doggett.
You can get full, complete relief here on that basis, can't you?
Absolutely, because there is no distinct loss flowing from the acts of bad faith. No harm resulted to the insured in this case
even beyond that, based on the evidence presented in this case, whether the damages were distinct or not, what evidence was offered of any damages in this case?
The only evidence that I can think of that was offered was the testimony of Mr. Stoker and Mrs. Stoker concerning the cost of repair to their vehicle, an uncovered casualty loss, and Mrs. Stoker's statement that she was very disappointed because she felt that the company was obligated to pay for the repairs to her vehicle. I mean, this is consistent with what the court has recently written in Moriel. We learned from Moriel that in order to recover punitive damages, to have gross negligence, you have to have conduct that is independent of and qualitatively different from the simple breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing, and that those types of punitive damages that flow from that are to remedy that type of conduct. Here, if you're talking about an extra contractual recovery in the absence of a contractual right to recover under the policy, it seems that you have to have distinct damages flowing from the tort. After all, if the tort cause of action is truly a separate and independent cause of action, shouldn't there be separate and independent damages that flow from that tort? And think about it in Vines. You have two causes of action, one on the contract for the amount due under the policy. The other was the bad faith claim, and what were the elements of damage there? Well, it wasn't merely the amount due under the policy.
Are you still just answering the question?
Yes, Your Honor, I'm sorry. Is my time up?
Your
I apologize.
Time's up.
I believe it's been answered.
If Judge Darling's satisfied, are there any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
Can you please report? Mr. Paul Fry will present argument for respondents.
May it please the court. Petitioner asserts that what we need to talk about in this case is coverage, and that's precisely what we should not talk about in this case. This court, in its recent decisions in Lyons and Dominguez and Moriel, has recognized that we must separate the distinct causes of action for breach of contract and the tort of breaching the duty of good faith and fair dealing. In fact, as Justice Cornyn wrote in Moriel, we agree with Justice Doggett when he says that claims for insurance contract coverage are distinct from those in tort for bad faith. Resolution of one does not determine the other. That analytical framework was utilized by this court in Dominguez and Lyons and Moriel to excuse the actions of an insurance adjuster where it was later found that there was a valid contract claim. But the court says we set aside the validity of the contract claim and we look at the actions of the adjuster in determining whether or not there was a reasonable basis for denial. Your Honors, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. And in this case, you should set aside the validity or invalidity of the respondent's contract rights and analyze the actions of the insurance adjuster in performing an evaluation of this claim and articulating a reasonable basis for denial.
Mr. Fry, yes. Under vials, following vials standard, the determination of the conduct of the insurance company in denying the claim is to be evaluated on the facts existing before the insurer. Under that standard, did the facts not justify denial of this claim?
No, Your Honor, they don't, because as the investigation of Mr. Ponce revealed, or trial, what we revealed about the investigation, he never obtained information as to how the accident actually occurred.
I'm not asking about what Mr. Ponce knew. I'm just talking about what the facts were before the insurance company.
Could Mr. Ponce have found that there had been no direct contact between the vehicles? He could have, with a reasonable investigation.
But that was a fact. That has not changed.
That is true. But the duty in Biles and in Arnold is not simply to find facts before or after the fact on which to deny a claim, but you must determine, and the insurance company must articulate at the time of denial a reasonable basis for denial. To quote Arnold, a cause of action for breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing is stated when it is alleged that there is no reasonable basis for denial of a claim or delay in payment, or a failure on the part of the insurer to determine whether there is any reasonable basis. In this case, the insurance company failed to determine if there was a reasonable basis. Well, why should an insurance carrier be held responsible for failing to make that determination? Why is that their duty? Well, first of all, this court has recognized the special relationship between an insurance company and an insurer. In an automobile accident case, it's even more of a special relationship. We don't have a freedom to contract in this state if we drive an automobile or not to contract. We must get automobile insurance. We don't get to negotiate the terms of the policy. We have to buy it, and we're stuck with whatever terms are contained in that policy. It's appropriate because of that relationship where you didn't have hard-headed businessmen bargaining as to the terms of the contract to put the duty on the insurance carrier to see if there's a valid contractual exclusion before it denies the claim. It's not an arbitrary standard. The insurance company chooses and selects the time and reason for denial.
Doesn't that transform, as the petitioner argues, the no reasonable basis test into the first basis claim test? That is, if we don't focus on whether there's any reasonable basis to deny or delay payment, we look at only whether the first reason was correct or not.
That's correct. And that is the holding of Biles and Arnold, that we look at the insurance.
That we look at the first basis upon which the denial was based.
That's true, Your Honor. And at the time of denial, and it's important to remember that the insurance company is selecting the time of denial. There's a new statute, which is in existence since this case, that's 2155, and the legislature has mandated prompt payment of claims and set specific deadlines for payment of claims. But even under that statute, an insurance company can expand the amount of time it has to investigate a claim by requesting additional time, requesting additional information. The insurance carrier gets to select the time of denial. And it is not inappropriate for this court to establish a common law standard holding the insurance company to a duty. When we decide to deny, we need to articulate a reasonable basis for denial. That doesn't contradict Lyons or Dominguez and Moriel. It may be that it's an erroneous basis, it was reasonable. Yes,
what is it about the nature of the relationship between an insurance company and an insured that requires that be true?
Your Honor, this court has recognized in Aranda and Arnold and going back to Stowers that we have a situation with insureds and insurance companies where there is not equal bargaining position, and there's potential for abuse in the denying of claims because, frankly, insurers are not sophisticated enough to evaluate whether or not the reasons for denial are legitimate or not. In this case, this claim was denied on the basis of case law that had not existed in the state of Texas for 20 years. Republic wrote Mrs. Stoker a letter and said, we're not going to pay because the uninsured driver was not the sole cause of this accident. That hadn't been the standard since 1973. That was the basis for denial. Mrs. Stoker couldn't know if that was legitimate or not. The insurance company should have had the duty to determine and articulate a reasonable basis for denial. That basis clearly was not.
Speaking generally, not yet about the specific facts of this case, why is it that, as opposing counsel said, that an insured is any worse off if they find out they lose now or lose a year and a half from now?
Your Honor, I think this goes to a somewhat technical distinction in how we designate damages in this case. This was not a claim made under the collision coverage of this policy. This was a claim made under the uninsured motorist provision of this policy. Mrs. Stoker's contract damages were whatever the uninsured driver owed her. Those were her contract damages, not just loss of use of the vehicle or property damage, but mental anguish, physical pain and suffering, maybe punitive damages if the uninsured driver had been grossly negligent. Because under the uninsured coverage, Republic stepped into the shoes of that uninsured driver. What she recovered at trial were her out-of-pocket expenses that she incurred in repairing her car after the claim was denied, and the mental anguish that she testified to at trial was not the mental anguish arising from the automobile accident, but the mental anguish arising from the denial of the claim. That's an important distinction because she gave up her contractual right of recovery, that is, all the damages the uninsured motorist would have owed her when the court granted summary judgment based on no contact.
She gave it up? The judge ruled against her?
Yes, Your Honor. We were summary
judgment. Well, which is it? Did she give it up or did the judge rule against her?
Well, the judge ruled against her, and at that
point...
She didn't
voluntarily give it up?
No, not at all.
Okay.
We were summary judgment out on the basis of the exclusion. So Republic was no longer liable under the contract for whatever damages the uninsured motorist had caused. But Republic remained liable because of its breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing. And importantly, because of its misrepresentation of the law under the DTPA and Texas Insurance Code, and that is the judgment in this case, statutory relief under the Texas Insurance Code. Importantly, those damages are distinct from the contract rights Mrs. Stoker had under the uninsured motorist coverage. It's technical, but it is an important distinction in determining what damages were caused by the wrongful denial.
As far as the actual evidence in this record of damages that she suffered, be they independent or not independent, does it consist solely of the proving up of the repair bill for $1,975 and her statement that she was upset that they didn't pay it?
There was testimony from Mrs. Stoker that she was upset and distraught over the fact that she was having to pay this, that she was upset with her dealings with the insurance adjuster because she could not get an adequate explanation as to why it was being denied and she didn't understand the reasons for that. We believe there is sufficient evidence to support the award of mental anguish and the out-of-pocket expenses that she paid. And in this case, there is an argument made by petitioner that there's no proximate cause, which I believe we've addressed by distinguishing uninsured motorist damages from the damages arising from the breach. But there is no error preserved on the sufficiency of the evidence on mental anguish or the out-of-pocket expenses.
What out-of-pocket expenses?
The $1,900 that she paid to fix her car. And that was her testimony.
Which, admittedly, were not covered, right?
No, Your Honor. That is a separate and distinct element of damages for Mrs. Stoker, apart from the uninsured motorist claim that she had against the uninsured driver and Republic through the uninsured motorist coverage. That is a different element of damages, her out-of-pocket expenses. Is it the same amount? Yes. It is the same amount of money.
But it's not a consequence of her mental anguish or not a consequence of any tort
that they inflicted on her, is it?
Yes, Your Honor.
Consequence of the collision she had.
Yes, Your Honor, because if Republic...
Would she have paid those expenses but for the collision?
If Republic had not denied this claim for a reasonable reason, she would not have had to have had the out-of-pocket expenses to repair the vehicle.
If they'd have paid the claim even though they didn't have to for a reasonable reason, she wouldn't have endured this mental anguish, right?
Well, if they had paid the claim, that is correct.
Because you're saying if they had denied it, saying there was no coverage, then she would have not fixed her car, or she would have fixed her car.
Oh, no.
But it would have, I mean, I'm just trying to follow up on Judge Gamage. Why is this $1,900 reasonable element regardless of how much anguish or not?
If they had denied the claim on the basis of a valid contractual exclusion, she may or may not have paid those expenses. She might well have incurred those.
Right.
But she incurred those expenses in this case because of the unreasonable denial of the claim without an articulated reasonable basis arising from the public's denial for no sole proximate cause on the driver. It's a very technical distinction, but it's the same and the same amount of damages, but she would not have incurred those had they articulated an appropriate reason at the time of denial. I guess one of the difficulties in this case is how do we hold the insurance carrier responsible for its culpable conduct at the time when, in fact, the damages would have incurred anyway if they had denied at the time? But we're again combining the contract claim with the tort claim, which this court has acknowledged in Dominguez and Lyons and Morial we cannot do. We have to separate out these two distinct causes of action. And she suffered tort damages as a result of the unreasonable denial by the insurance company. We mentioned Article 2155.
Counsel. If there's no contract of insurance under which the claim can be recovered, is there still a relationship, a special relationship with regard to that claim?
Yes, Your Honor, there is, because there was a contract. There may have been a valid exclusion which was not put forward, but there was a contract. This is not a situation which this court has addressed before, where there was fraud in inducement of the insurance contract by the insured, and there is no contract at that point from which a duty of good faith and fair dealing can arise.
If there's no contractual right of recovery for this claim, why should we be as concerned with the disproportionate bargaining power as between the insured and the insurance company when there's no coverage?
Your Honor, I believe the reason we should be concerned is because we have public policy concerns about prompt payment of claims. That is in 2155. In addition, in 2155, there is a cumulative remedy provision which states that the remedies contained in 2155, which is basically a strict liability statute. If you don't pay within a certain time period, the insurance company, you're liable. And in addition, you have to pay 80% interest. There's a cumulative remedy provision which states that this is not an exclusive remedy.
And are you arguing that by analogy here, or you did not sue under that statute, did you?
No, because it was not in effect at the time. But at the time of that statute, which states this is not an exclusive remedy, and an insured still has remedies under the common law of this state in September of 1991 was Viles and Arnold. There is a presumption that the people of Texas, when they enacted 2155, understood the rationale of Viles and Arnold and adopted this court's holdings in those cases, that we judge an insurance carrier's denial at the time of denial to determine the reasonableness of the insurance carrier's conduct at that time. That is appropriate because insurance carriers evaluate thousands of claims, and they should bear the responsibility for articulating a reasonable basis for denial.
Mr. Fry, how do you respond in this line of argument to Mr. Hood's comment that you don't need bad faith to have a cause of action against an insurance company that causes damage for its dealings with its client? Following Justice Cornyn's comment to his background, if the insurance company has a contractual agreement with the insurer to pay money, the historical law was that that was a contract action, and the individual had to sue the insurance company for breach of contract if they failed to obligate. And as a matter of public policy, this court back in the 80s decided that because of this, quote, special relationship, we're going to punish an insurance company for failure to comply with its contract because of the unequal bargaining power. So there will be basically a surcharge. If the insurance company breaches a contract, there's going to be a surcharge on top of the contract damages. And we're going to call this bad faith. They're going to have a separate liability, separate damages, to make it more expensive for the insurance company to breach the contract than to simply not pay the money. What's the rationale when there is no contract obligation to pay? There is no. What is the rationale that says that we have to have some additional cause of action for this other kind of cause when there is no contract? And that goes to Mr. Hood's argument that we already have causes of action where one party is takes a detrimental action to themselves in reliance upon the conduct of another party, and why isn't that sufficient to handle the damages under the facts that you're alleging in this case?
Your Honor, your question assumes that the duty of good faith and fair dealing exists on the basis that there is a valid contract claim. And that's not why that duty exists. The duty exists because the insured and the insurance company have entered into an insurance contract, and the duty arises at that point. There may never be a claim of any type under the policy, or there may be many claims, but the duty arises at the inception of that contract, and that duty existed when Abe Ponce, on behalf of the public insurance, was supposed to investigate this claim and determine, is there a basis for denial, or should we pay the claim? The validity of the claim, and this is again what the court has emphasized, in Moriel, and Dominguez, and Lyons, is not the concern. That's not what gives rise to the duty, whether or not the claim is valid. The contractual relationship, at the time it is made, gives rise to that duty. And that duty was violated at the time of denial in this case.
Of course, under Aranda and Arnold, insurance company can be liable for delaying payment. And if, in this instance, Republic had not denied the claim immediately, but had ultimately denied the claim based on contact, would your client have a cause of action for delay?
If there had been unreasonable delay, in fact, to substantiate that, that was not the consideration in this case.
But that would be actionable under our holdings.
It could be under certain circumstances. If the delay was unreasonable, even if the
only reason given was no coverage and that was proved to be ultimately correct, you would still have a cause action for unreasonable delay.
If the delay could be proven by the evidence at trial to have been unreasonable and damages separate and apart from the contract have been incurred.
What kind of damages? Say mental anguish damages?
Perhaps. Or during the pendency of denial, I have to go into bankruptcy because I have to pay the property damage claim myself.
Even if you ultimately would have to pay it?
Because if there had been an extremely long period of time before denial, yes, I think that is possible. That's a possible claim. And again, the legislature in passing 2155 is presumed to have known about Viles and Aranda and Arnold.
Let me be sure I understand exactly what you're arguing in the simplest terms, if I may, and correct me if I'm wrong. What I think I'm hearing is that you're arguing that duty exists because the insurance company and the insured have entered into a contract, even if the claim is invalid. Here, the duty was violated at the time of denial because it was denied for the wrong reason, even though there was another valid but undiscovered reason for denial. Is that right?
That's true, Your Honor. And that may seem like an onerous burden and arbitrary and unfair, but we set, by statute and by common law, time frames and statute of limitations that are sometimes unfair and unjust. If a person's family is killed by a drunk driver and they come to my office 2 years and a day later, I have to tell them, you don't have a claim because you're a day late. There's nothing just about that, but in administering justice, we have to have that type of standard. This court in a bad faith setting, in Murray v. San Jacinto, applied a 2-year statute of limitations for breach of duty, good faith, and fair dealing, tying it to what time frame? The time of denial. Because Justice Gonzalez recognized in that opinion, that's the time of the wrongdoing, is when the claim is denied. And we're going to put the burden on the insured to bring that claim within 2 years of the time of the denial. The same standard should apply to the insurance carrier. We're going to judge you by your actions at the time of denial, not on something that you uncover at a later date. If I may sum up by paraphrasing a Johnny Cash song, I shot a man in Memphis just to see him die. Later on, I found out all kinds of justifications for that murder, all types of defenses which would have allowed me to kill that man. But at the time I did it, I just wanted to see him die. My culpability is established when I commit the act. The insurance carrier's culpable conduct in this case was established at the time of denial. And this court, without reference
Are
to the validity...
Are you still answering Judge Damage's question?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe I am, but I will conclude.
One sentence or less.
We ask that you affirm the judgment.
Any other questions?
Thank you, counsel.
Mr. Fry and lawyers like he and myself at least have the 2 years and one day to worry about. The claims representative nowadays looks at 15 days. And what did the legislature say to the claims representative and his employer? They said, don't worry, we understand that there will be times when you're not going to be able to meet these deadlines, but nonetheless, you'll have a good reason for denying the claim. And so what did the legislature do? They said, you're not going to be subject to the 18% penalty. You're not going to have to pay attorney's fees. And you're not going to have to pay the loss if the claim is determined otherwise to be invalid through either litigation, arbitration, or just through the negotiation process with the insurer. The analogy to Article 2155 fails. Article 2155 preserves whatever remedies Mr. and Mrs. Stoker may have had in this case. Why didn't they sue under this statute? It didn't exist. Had it existed, could they have sued under it? No. They would have lost because they had no valid claim. Now we hear now that the damages for the repair of the vehicle are somehow distinct from the damages that would have been recovered from the uninsured tortfeasor in this case. Well, I found that curious because the lawyers have an ongoing process where they think things through, but I guess at the time that the lawsuit was filed, which is what we really need to measure this case against, if you look at the causes of action, there are damages enumerated under each cause of action. Under the cause of action for breach of contract, we see property damage, $1,975. Under the cause of action for breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing, property damage, $1,975. And it goes on under both negligence and under the statutory causes of action. In short, there are no distinct damages here. The Stokers recovered damages for an uncovered casualty loss that was not within their policy. Files. The relationship between the two causes of action. They're separate, to be sure, but they're clearly related. Because if you don't have the contract, the relationship never exists, and the tort duties never arise. Best evidence of that. In this case, look at the jury verdict. Questions 1 through 4, subpart C, all predicated liability upon negligence and gross negligence of Southwestern Republic in failing to timely pay the claim. They had no obligation to pay the claim. A year earlier, the trial court had said there was no coverage. Question 5 for Republic, was there an absence of a reasonable basis? Of course there wasn't. The judge had said a year earlier, there was no contact, there is no claim under this policy. It's difficult for me to envision a more reasonable. A district judge has said that. Question 6B and 8, not settling or attempting to settle the Stoker's claim after liability on the policy has become reasonably clear. The liability on the policy never became reasonably clear, and the judge's summary judgment proved that. Well, what does all of this establish? It establishes what we all intuitively know.
and that is that bad faith presupposes a valid claim under the contract. And why do we know that?
Could you also, though, construe that there still is an underlying contract, even though the claim is denied?
Absolutely.
And so it's not totally with the, for example, the insurer still has obligations to treat the insured in good faith. And so whether ultimately the claim is denied, it doesn't destroy the contractual relationship.
If I may, I understand what you're saying. The contractual relationship still continues. To be sure, there is a duty there to deal fairly with the insured and deal in good faith.
I think that's the answer.
But one thing, what are the damages that flow from the breach of that?
Yes.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the first cause. The court will take a brief recess.
The audience